Good morning and welcome to a Wednesday. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. This is The Conversation, and it would not be complete without you.
Let's hope
Mr.
not.
Mr. Vandercook, sir.
Good morning, Beth.
Good morning.
You know, we've grown up with the idea that you know, the more education you can get, the better, essentially.
Right, and that it's going to increase your chances of having a better life,
yep.
And that you're going to make more money, and you're going to be able to, you know, have the kind of experiences that only money can buy. But, you know, with generations of Americans who have grown up hearing that the benchmark of their success starts with getting a good education, there's now a little bit of questioning about that, you know. By the same token, these days, that advice seems to be even truer for people with just a high school diploma because finding decent jobs is difficult. And compared to their parents who could move up the economic ladder, people with only a high school education, well, they are simply moving down. If the key to reducing income inequality is a college education, a fair question is then how well specific kinds of schools are supporting that so-called mobility. Now, Pioneering Studies seeks to answer that question. Contributing editor Neil Milner had a look at the mobility report cards, and he joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
The idea that, okay, if you go to school and you get a great education, I mean, that still holds, but it seems that in looking at these report cards, it only holds for certain people.
Well, first of all, you start out by saying the studies still show, the research still shows that overall you're much better off income-wise and mobility-wise to have a college education or at least 2 years. And if you don't have that, that's increasingly hard to function and to find decent jobs in society. That's the same. What this study does is to look at how schools deal with the issue of social mobility. You have to start with the idea that there isn't that much social mobility in America, certainly less than the myths say. But this particular study done by people who are really experts in the field, Raj Chetty and a whole bunch of other folks, looked at 30 million college students who attended college.
That's a lot of college students.
Well, not only did they look at they also did some financial stuff so that they can look at family income success in college. And one of the main things they were looking at is what schools do the best at bringing students from the lower 20% in income to the higher 20% in income compared to what others would be like, say, at the age of 30 when you're out for a while.
Okay, so let's talk about the schools against which everybody else wants to be measured, the Ivy Leagues.
Well, if you measure mobility, you measure success. They measure success by two things. You have to understand that, and we'll do that very quickly. One of which is the percentage of low-income students that are in a school, and the other is the percentage of low-income students who move up to that higher income bracket, the top 20%. By the time they're in their 30s. The Ivy Leagues do the best in getting the students that they have, low-income students, to move up into the higher group, and that's a pretty significant jump. But the Ivy League and some other elite schools educate so few of low-income students that, in fact, the best schools in mobility report cards are the schools that have much greater access,
right,
and then do pretty well. Those are what he calls mid-tier schools.
Right, and we'll talk about that in a second, but the whole point about Ivy League schools doing well for those they take in from low incomes, that's indisputable, but the point is they don't take that many of them in. So, again, that barrier, the access, which can be driven in some cases by money, but the mid-tier schools is where a lot of families will look because the schools are good schools.
Oh, absolutely.
But they may not be Ivy League schools, but that's okay because a good school can bring you a good education and consequently a good life. How is the access how is access to those schools?
Well, the access to those schools, and we're talking here, they give some examples. You know, they have so much data. Somewhere in there, you might be able to find out a score for the University of Hawaii. But my initial look at what they made available, I couldn't find it. But schools like State University of New York and Stony Brook, University of Texas, El Paso, some of the California state universities, they just have ways of allowing the barriers, probably the cost barriers, the understanding barriers, the familiarity that low-income students have, are lower than the Ivy League colleges. you're the person who's in the 1% income bracket family is 77 times more likely to go to a Ivy school than a person in the lower income thing. So these schools that have the highest scores have just make it possible to go or into these places, probably because, as I say, they're cheaper and they're more familiar.
In a lot of ways, Neil, that sounds pretty logical, that you might expect that would happen. But how are these schools actually doing in terms of whether or not they're that successful with the access? Because my understanding reading this is that, for example, the mid-tier schools have decreased.
Well, that's what's happened recently. What they say two things. The main point they say is you can identify schools that get the best kind of mobility scores, and those are those mid-tier. But what they've also found is that within that big body of data, they found that these very schools, the schools that do the best, their access has decreased over time. They can't identify why. It probably has something to do with money. So that the schools that have the best combination of getting their students to be upwardly mobile and having a lot of access to the students, the access may be getting less than it was before, which is not a good sign.
Access from a monetary perspective is one thing, but also there's the issue of what you have to do to get into the college to begin with. That brings us to SAT scores.
Well,
what do they say about SAT scores?
They don't say much about SAT scores. The people who have written about it, Richard Reeves, who wrote about this study, talks about SAT scores. And this is the big reminder that there is a bigger picture here about inequality that we have to understand. Whatever the success of some of these schools, the gap, the racial gap on SAT scores, particularly in math, is just about as huge as it has been before. And that's a fairly good predictor about whether you go to college and how well that you will do later on. And what Reeves points out is that given what we know about privilege, and given what we know, and you and I have talked about this on the show before, about the diverging differences between people with college education, cultural differences, family differences, educational differences. As Reeves says, there is this diverging experiences and knowledge and maybe even prenatal stuff that affects you right up to the time when you take that SAT scores, take that SAT test, and that the reflection that you really get of these SAT differences is about these divergences.
I mean, which brings up two kind of very scary things. First of all, knowing that it's not necessarily about all the SAT prep that you might do going into college or trying to get into college, and also the fact that in recent years the SAT has been retooled for expressly the reasons that you just talked about.
Well, they say, Reeves says, that the SAT, that this is not about the cultural limitations of SATs. He doesn't think that that's a factor in these kind of math things. But remember, when you say something like SAT prep, what that really reflects is a kind of networking, a kind of counseling, all this kind of stuff that some people have a lot of and other people don't. And it goes back to what we said before, the differences between low-income families that don't know very much about college and may be intimidated by it and don't have lots of places to go, and other people.
And really quickly, because we got about 30 seconds, so having read through this, which people looked at as being a pioneering study to be able to compare all of this, what's the big takeaway for parents?
Well, the big takeaway from parents is, first of all, if your kids can go to college, have them go to college. Secondly, that there are good schools available in your areas, likely mid-tier schools that make it possible. But the message here is not simply for parents. The message here is to understand how much college and upward mobility is about these other kinds of factors that take place well before you're talking about entering college.
And that's the bottom line. Thanks so much.
Sure.
We'll talk to you in a couple of weeks. Neil Milner is a retired professor of political science, and he is a contributing editor to The Conversation. He joins us biweekly with The Long View.
This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, a Honolulu Theater for Youth world premiere. But first, your quiz.
In today's backyard quiz, we thought about a crusading lawman who changed the nature of crime fighting in Hawaii. He was the Honolulu City Prosecutor during a period when organized crime figures dominated local news, and he didn't hesitate to criticize politicians, defense attorneys, and even judges who opposed him. One of his deputies said he was one of the first people who shook the trees of heaven, the powers that be. He really went after people who were abusing and misusing the political system, one of the first to really go after these guys, and it really set the pace for what the office would become today. He was Honolulu's first elected prosecuting attorney and was credited by friends and fellow prosecutors with significantly reducing the island's crime rates. He created the prosecutor's first felony narcotics and white-collar crime units. He was a third-generation Kamaaina with a love of Hawaiian history. He died in 2007 at the age of 84. This morning, we're looking for his name. If you know, call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689.
Good morning. I'm Jason Hoffman from Mensa Hawaii. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Our most basic notions of who we are get formed so early in our lives, and the lessons we learn in those first few years are so important. Playwright Annie Cusick-Wood has a way of connecting to those lessons through theater, crafting plays for the very young. Her newest production, Coming to Honolulu Theater for Youth, looks at the importance and the meaning of home. Good morning, Annie.
Good morning, Chris. How are you?
You know, in your work, you've got this combination of a very simple idea that's also a very complex idea. This is another example of that, I think.
Yes. Once again, as an artist, we are shaped by what's going on around us all the time. Mm-hmm. And HTY, we usually plan a couple of years ahead of, you know, about the place that we're going to do. And so home originally had, you know, I had one idea about home, but in the last year, it's become really a reflection of what's happening. And we've really enjoyed exploring it. So, yes, it's a very simple idea of two people, two characters. One is called Me, mm-hmm. I wonder why, and the other one's called Oh, I wonder why. So, and Me, they start off as friends, and they randomly play this game. They play junk in a pole. Everybody here knows that. And the Me wins a box. So he gets a box, and in the box is another box, and then another box, and then in that box is a house. So he gets this house, mm-hmm. and O is left going, oh.
Yeah.
Know? So at that point, you know, the children are like, yay, you know, Me got the house.
Right.
And, oh, that's a shame. O didn't get the house. So then what happens from being friends and starting off together on the journey, he accumulates loads and loads of stuff in his house, mm-hmm. as he calls it, stuffy stuff, Sophie sofas and cherry chairs. And
uh-huh.
Oh wants that as well, because she's left in a pile of rubble. So she's left outside. So she, you know, she's like, why don't I have what you have? Mm-hmm. And that was the big question that we started with, was like, you know, how come I was born into this really beautiful, safe life? And,
exactly.
You know, we hear stories of other, you know, children in other countries who really have, you know, an awful life. So is it random? Is it as simple as rock, paper, scissors that things turn out like that? Mm-hmm. And we don't know the answer to that, but it's just, you know, deeper questions within the story. So, of course, the thing about Me, you know, like at some point the kids go, yeah, Me's got the house and O wants it, and O doesn't deserve it because she didn't win it. And then she takes it from him and she mistreats it a little bit, you know. So it's a bit like, if you're going to take my house, be nice to it. Be kind to it, you know. Yeah. And she's like shaking it about and seeing what it can do. So eventually he gets a bit tired of that. And he says, no, you're going to stay out. He draws a line down the middle and he sends her out. And then he builds a wall around his house so that she cannot get in.
And this is what happens to, they've started as friends.
They started as friends. I mean, it's a play for very young, so it's 36 minutes long.
Yeah.
So it moves very quickly. So she's left out on her own and a bit lost, you know.
Sure. Right?
Has got nothing left, and it's cold and it's scary and it's dark, and he's got this beautiful house with all this stuff. And then she finds her inner strength. And theatrically, we get to, you know, play with that beautifully. And it's a puppet, just like her. So it's like a mini-me that kind of emerges. And then this puppet is like, I'm not giving up. So she is a bit mischievous in the beginning of trying to get in the house, but then becomes very resilient and creates her own home in the form of a boat. So that's where the story goes then. And that's kind of beautiful because then, of course, a storm comes.
Sure.
And, we can figure out like how the boat does in the storm and how the house does in the storm, because it's actually a tornado, so you know, it lifts up things. So in the end they come together in the end, obviously, because it is a story of hope and friendship and connectedness, and they find a way to share in the end that suits both of them. You know, that, oh, helps me out, you know, and when actually you sort of think, well, she's not going to, because he's been quite mean to her. But I think it's quite balanced, the story, but it's very funny. The children are really enjoying it. You know, as usual, it's got very sparse dialogue because it's for the very young. It's visual, and it's a very, you know, of course, it's a very current theme. You know, building walls, yeah. But it's not the first time that we've heard this.
Well, so many ideas, Annie, for a 3-year-old, and yet they become accessible. That's the
totally. And we had the real privilege a few weeks ago of having two ladies from UH who are. They're early years educational psychologists, and they came in to watch a run through before we'd gone out on the road with it. And they said it hit all the right buttons for the children that age. And the one thing that the kids could understand about the election was that there might be a wall that was going to be built.
Mm-hmm.
That was the one thing that a 3-year-old could understand about it. So as a visual tool, it was an interesting thing for us to have at that time. Of course, it's also very loosely based on Oscar Wilde's A Selfish Giant. You know, he builds a wall around his garden as well. But it's about that, about, you know, who, you well, know, why we love to share and what we don't love to share, you know.
Well, homes can be, you know, we need them. We get comfort from them. Mm-hmm. We get security from them. We get the whole rooted, you know, security that we want mm-hmm. to be able to go on with our lives. But they can also, we can use them to exclude mm-hmm. or we can use them to include, right?
Yes.
And you can cut the world off or you can open up to the world. That's part of what you're saying, isn't it?
Yes, definitely. Because our character cuts himself off, he doesn't, there's a radio broadcast about the storm coming. He doesn't hear it because he's just not listening anymore. He doesn't see all the beautiful things that are happening. He doesn't see the dolphins outside his window.
Mm-hmm.
He misses out because he's built his wall so high. So he's missing out on his experience of the world that O is having in her boat. So, yeah, we can't close ourselves off. You know, of course, it's beautiful to have a lovely home and just to be all safe and comfortable within it. But, there, you know, as social beings, we do like to share. You know, I remember when I was very young going to India and seeing the Himalayas, and I had nobody to share it with, really. And I thought, oh, when I have children, I want to come back here with them and just go, look at this. You know, because it makes the joy of, you know, a great meal or, you know, a great movie or a beautiful view even
incomplete.
More satisfying if you have somebody to say, look, or
right.
How is it? You know, we want other people to feel good. So I think it's inherent in our nature to want people to be as happy and comfortable and have the same joy as us. But somehow things get in the way, you know.
Well, you've also, you know, you're addressing very young children, but you're also being very candid with them about the idea that some have homes, some do not.
Yes, and that, of course, is a huge issue in Hawaii as in the rest of the world. So, yeah, I mean, I know that in schools there are children who don't have who don't have homes in here in our island, and they, you know, they go to school, and it's, you know, they move around a lot as well. I mean, they move to, from school to school because they don't want the other people to know in the school. So there's all that, and that's almost like a whole other show. I mean, we touch on that very lightly when our character O is left outside when he's comfortable and she's alone. You know, that's there very slightly, and her inner strength is a lovely thing to see. But that's, yeah, that's a really, really awful situation that, you know, I wish we had the answer to that. I mean, maybe somebody really smart does. I don't know.
Someday, Annie.
Yeah, someday. We can just keep doing the art and, you know, keep giving out hope and making kids laugh. It's a very, very funny play. It's not really, it's not heavy. It sounds heavy, but it's not. It's a lot of fun.
A lot of ideas in it. Thank you so much, Annie.
Oh, thanks for having me in again. Thank you.
Annie Cusick-Wood is the author of Home, a world premiere short play for the smallest of theater patrons, presented by Honolulu Theater for Youth. Showtimes are Saturdays, February 18th, 11th, 18th, and 25th at 9:30 and 11:30 a.m. at Tenney Theater on the grounds of the Cathedral of St. Andrew in Honolulu.
Different idea of toddlerhood. How can a toddler almost die from assault? And the investigation falls so short of best practices. That's the question we're asking in today's Reality Check with Civilbeat reporter Chad Blair. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann. This is a tough story today.
This is for any good parent to read that a toddler could be assaulted in a way, in any way, is just unthinkable, unbelievable. And yet here is this little child who was clearly attacked 2 years ago, and the investigation didn't seem to follow protocol. Why?
Well, I'll tell you what we do know. John Hill has spent a lot of time talking to people, looking over the police report, which, by the way, is heavily redacted. But we're talking about a 17-month-old child named Peyton, and he was found with blood in the brain, probably from a blow to the head. Part of the skull actually had to be removed in order to relieve pressure. This was at Queen's Hospital.
Because his brain is actually shifted, right?
Exactly, exactly. And then there were bruises on the back of the child, looking like handprints, actually. Bleeding in the retinas, probably from either shaking or a severe impact. It's clear that the child was exposed to neglect and abuse. What is not clear is who did it. And even though HBD investigated, there was never any resolution to that. The case that was presented to prosecutors went nowhere. There was no admissible evidence.
But there's another wrinkle in this, too.
Well, there is, and it's actually quite shocking. So this took place probably at a daycare center in Eva Beach, and the woman that runs the daycare center is married to a police officer, HPD. The woman was taking care of Peyton, as her two children were there as well. And it appears that the investigators, at least the strong insinuation from the story, is they really did not do what was normal in these kind of abuse cases. For example, they took too long to investigate, to actually interview some of the people involved. It appears they may never have even visited the daycare itself and searched the premises. John talked to a number of child abuse experts nationally, also locally, who said this is just not how you do it. So it raises the question, is because of the HBD connection, was that the reason the case never developed?
Chad, we got to go in just about 30 seconds, but clearly there are so many things about this case we don't know, including whether there will be any sense of justice for this child and an answer for the parents. How is this child functioning today?
Doing much better, 3 years old now. The problem is you just don't know what the lasting impact of trauma might be. Real quickly, HPD will not comment directly on the case. They do say they are still reviewing it. We actually will have an interview posted with the mother of Peyton later today, so check our homepage.
Thanks very much, Huff. A story that we don't ever want to have to do a reality check about, but this one seems to be crying out for one. Thanks so much.
Thanks, John.
Every day we talk with Chad Blair from Civilbeat, who gives us a reality check. Very often we've heard from psychologists who believe they need prescriptive authority. How often? One psychologist says over a dozen times in various legislative sessions, and that each time the bills to allow psychologists to prescribe have failed for the same reason. They unnecessarily jeopardize the health and safety of patients. UH Manoa psychology professor emerita Elaine Hybe is one of the founders of a group opposed to prescriptive authority. She says she believes her profession has its limitations. We sat down to talk about them.
Well, the limitations are is that unlike other non-physician providers like nurses who've obtained prescription privileges, they were already medically trained. Nurses take pre-medical training as undergraduates, medical training as graduates. Whereas with psychology, it's not a medical profession. There's no pre-medical training or medical training. So this prescribing idea is really crossing disciplinary boundaries rather than expanding a scope of practice as we've seen in nursing, for example. So psychologists are not trained for medical practice. The objections are that if they choose to practice medicine, then obtain a standard amount of medical training, such as what nurse practitioners obtain. But instead, they're arguing that medical school, 10 years of medical school, including pre-med, or 6 years of nursing school can be condensed into 1 year of online training. That's radical. That's an extraordinary reduction in training. And if that's to be undertaken, there should be extraordinary amount of evidence that that would protect the consumer.
And for consumers, perhaps an extraordinary board which understands what that training is meant to do and to be able to rate appropriately those who have undertaken it. And you say that's also an issue, that the board itself may simply not know what it doesn't know.
That's a really good point. The bill we're talking about would give the oversight to the Board of Psychology, and they're not physicians. They're not medically trained. In Louisiana, where there is a prescribing law, the prescribing psychologists themselves introduced a bill very quickly arguing that we need to be under the medical board. We're practicing medicine here, and the Board of Psychology doesn't know how to oversee it. And that became law in Louisiana. So that is another good issue. Who's going to monitor these psychologists?
So with the limited expertise that you see on both sides of the equation, those who might undergo the training and those who would have to verify it and rate it to allow someone to have prescriptive authority, you see some ethical considerations. Is there anything that you might see changed about this bill that would allow you to change your mind?
Oh, absolutely. In Illinois, there was the only bill met with consensus by medical, nursing organizations and psychologists, consumer groups. And the bill in Illinois requires psychologists to undergo training equivalent to what in that state is required for physician assistants. This is standard medical training. There's pre-medical undergraduate courses and medical graduate courses, and a 14-month rotation in the training under supervision, covering the various specialties of medicine that one would encounter as a prescribing psychologist. So that level of training does not raise objections in any direction that I know of.
If you're talking about a 14-month period in which someone would be supervised,
mm-hmm.
how much training would also be included in the time frame that someone would have to plan if they were to be compliant with the Illinois law?
How long would it take to undergo the training? Well, the coursework involved, I would say, would take a few years. It would be almost equivalent to a nurse practitioner, maybe 4 years with that 14-month practicum that's required. That 14-month, it rotates through various medical specialties, is in stark contrast to what this bill requires, which is 100 patients, nothing specified about that. And in fact, that could be finished in a couple weeks. So the difference in rigor is extreme.
Because we are an island state, we often hear that it's difficult for people to find what they need when they need it. And therefore, those people who are medically trained or trained in psychology need to be able to do as much as they can right there in those communities. Even in a state like ours, where we know we have a profound physician shortage, how would you see that working perhaps differently than what we've already talked about in terms of having a patient-centered home?
There are bills this session at the legislature addressing telepsychiatry. HB 1272 is one of them. And that would allow psychologists on the rural, in rural areas on neighbor islands to collaborate with a psychiatrist on Oahu if necessary. And hopefully that bill will make progress. And I would hope the psychologists proposing their bills would see also that that would be something to support.
So as you talk to many of your fellow psychologists, how divisive is this?
It was divisive from the beginning. And the reason it became divisive is, I hope I don't get too technical here, but when the idea was presented at the American Psychological Association, had the rules of the organization been followed, representatives on the council would have returned to their constituents and discussed the matter and then decided on a vote after consultation with the psychologists. But that didn't happen. The rules were suspended and the proposal to pursue prescribing was passed without discussion with the constituents. And that began the problem. Not all psychologists were on board from the beginning and have never really been included in the discussion of, is it a good idea? And if so, how would we approach it?
Aside from the idea of changing the bill itself, is there anything else that's happening within your world to be able to bridge that gap, to be able to extend the argument to those who believe that, you know, the bill should absolutely pass?
From us who oppose these kinds of bills, we've argued, well, similar laws were passed in New Mexico and Louisiana. So you have a natural experiment. And if this radical reduction in medical training is actually adequate, if it yields consumer safety, why not study that in New Mexico and Louisiana and present that evidence? The implication would be extraordinary. This bill would have much more footage, much more validity in its arguments in reducing training. But one could also begin to question, are we requiring much too much training for physicians and nurses, other medical providers, if indeed this training can be reduced to 1 year of online classes?
Thank you so much for your perspective.
Thank you very much for having me.
Elaine Hybe is a professor emerita of psychology at the University of Hawaii at Manoa and a Hawaii licensed psychologist. She helped found the volunteer advocacy organization Psychologist Opposed to Prescription Privileges for Psychologists. She's also a member of its board of advisors. A public hearing on SB 384, the Prescriptive Authority Bill, is scheduled for tomorrow at 9 a.m.
The harp, the piano, the soprano voice. There are few chamber music pieces written for this trio of instruments. On Saturday, February 18th, enjoy a unique evening with harpist Megan Bledsoe Ward, pianist Susan Wingrove Reed, and soprano Rachel Schutz, only in HPR's Atherton Studio. tickets at 955-8821 during business hours or at hprtickets.org. Sponsored by Bonnie Rice and the Rice Partnership Wealth Management.
Aloha, I'm Tracy Yamamura from Hawaii Arts Alliance. Join the conversation on Twitter. Talk back to your radio at HI Conversation.
Tonight at 5, it's Bite Marks Cafe with Bert Lum and Ryan Ozawa. And Bert, I've got to ask you, what's an XLR8 UH accelerator?
Well, you know, if you actually say it really fast, it's accelerate.
Oh.
XLR8.
You see, that's where I went wrong.
And the, I mean, you know, we've talked about accelerators, and we've had a number of them on the show, like Blue Startups. And the Accelerate UH folks are closely tied by the hip to the University of Hawaii.
Sure.
And in order for you to be a participant in their program, you have to have some connection, whether it's, you know, you could be a student, you could have some IP that came out of UH, you could have perhaps the maybe one of the professors part of your company. So any sort of relationship that you have with UH, you could be a potential candidate for Accelerate UH. And it's another accelerator program where they mentor companies and give them all the kind of tools that they need to succeed once they, you know, sort of graduate. And what we're going to do today is talk a bit about the program and more importantly, kind of focus in on a couple of companies that are in the current cohort. One of them is called Natural Resource Data Solutions, and another one is called Herbivore Tools. They're both sort of in the ag tech sector.
Yeah.
So we want to explore what's the opportunity in this ag tech sector.
You wouldn't think that the connection would be that close between that one world and the other, but you're finding out otherwise, it sounds like.
Well, you know, I think there's and we did this before just a couple of about a month ago with Blue Startups. We had an ag sector discussion, and you know, there's a lot of interest on the part of Hawaii to be more self-sustaining, self-sufficient in terms of agriculture and food production. So I think there's interest in looking at some of these companies as startups and see how perhaps the accelerator program could, you know, help ensure their success in the marketplace.
You and Ryan have watched a lot of accelerator programs. Have they been pretty effective?
Oh, I think absolutely. You know, what we need to see is just more companies having a solid go at it. And I think it's all about the numbers, right? Getting them out there and trying to get them to succeed.
Sounds like a plan, Bert. Thanks very much.
Sure thing.
That's Bite Marks Cafe tonight at 5 p.m. In today's Backyard Quiz, we're remembering a former city prosecutor who built his reputation fighting organized crime. He was working as an attorney for the city in 1975 when his 19-year-old son was murdered in what was believed to be an organized crime hit. His efforts to solve the crime led him to run for prosecutor in 1980. He served two terms and earned a reputation as a combative and fearless attorney. His office was able to bring about several organized crime prosecutions, including that of his son's killer. Prosecutor Keith Kaneshiro, a former deputy who succeeded him in office, said he, quote, brought a lot of issues to public light, pornography, murder, organized crime, and made the discussion of crime a number one issue. He was a Punahou graduate and World War II veteran who served with amphibious forces in the Pacific, a third-generation Kama'aina. He earned a degree in economics from Tufts University and a law degree from Northeastern University in Boston. He died in 2007 at the age of 84, and his name was Charles Marsland.
Glenn Okimura called us from Pahala, knew the answer, as apparently did many, many people, which is good news to know.
I would hope so, yeah.
He was well-remembered. And we thank you all for joining us for today's Backyard Quiz. If you've got a quiz question for us, you can always send it in to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Achieve 3000. The 2017 Literacy Leadership Conference and student celebrations are February 6th through 9th on Kauai, Maui, Hawaii Island, and Oahu. Achieve3000.com/Hawaii.
everyone has a secret in an Agatha Christie story, and almost anyone could have done the foul deed that sets the story in motion. The Kilauea Drama and Entertainment Center on Hawaii Island is casting a production of Christie's play, Murder on the Nile, and director Susie Bond is looking for actors who look as if they have something to hide. Good morning, Susie.
Good morning, Chris. How are you today?
All right. I think it would be an awful lot of fun to be in an Agatha Christie production because you get to be someone quite other than who you are on the surface, right?
Well, that's true. That's true. There's always little hidden motives everywhere, and the characters are always so much fun.
Even if they're, you know, very upright citizens, they, you know, you might have a dark secret in your past, yeah?
Yes, and that's what makes it all so much fun is when all those red herrings come out and you're not sure whether or not that's the person who done the evil deed.
Well, what kind of characters are you looking for in this particular casting?
Well, there's the fun side characters like the French maid and the niece who is the traveling companion and the crazy old biddy who is expecting everybody to bow to her whims.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the young couple, Kay and Simon, who have just married, and Kay's friend and Simon's ex-girlfriend, Jacqueline, who is causing them a little bit of problem. And then there's the German doctor and a captain and a steward and some bead sellers, and as well as the canon Pennefeather, who is originally this is Death on the Nile, which had Hercule Poirot.
Right.
But there's a whole licensing thing that goes on with his name, so the character is changed to Canon Pennefeather, who is the one who is he's the bride's sort of uncle. You know, one of those British uncles that's the best friend of the family type of person.
And he's the guy who figures it out and brings everybody together in the room. Right.
Although this doesn't actually do one of those everybody in the room jacuzzi kind of thing that a lot of the other ones do.
Yeah.
This one kind of works its way out a little more subtly in towards the end. But it, you know, as with all Agatha Christie, they're just so much fun to do. And last night as we were getting ready to audition, there was this thick fog in Volcano, and it was like, this is the perfect weather to audition an Agatha Christie in. So that was kind of fun. You know, it's those little touches and that make it kind of special.
You know, it's maybe only a British author could pull this off. Your subject is always murder. Murder most foul, and it's always kind of witty and funny and lighthearted. It's never, you know, it's never too doom-laden, no matter where she goes with her story.
Right. There's not a lot of gratuitous bloodshed in it, that's for sure.
Right.
And that's always, you know, I'm not a big fan of gratuitous bloodshed, so...
Well, you know, one of the things that happens in her and in a lot of good British novels is without any kind of real allusion to the actual crime, you get a very sinister mood that's set around it, yeah?
Right. So, and that, you know, I mean, this is our third Agatha Christie. So we've done Mousetrap and we've done And Then There Were None. And I've been waiting a while to get back and do another Agatha Christie. And this is sort of a tribute to my mother who passed away in October. So she was the one that introduced me to Agatha Christie and who always ever, you know, was... whenever I was bored when I was young, well, read this. It's Agatha Christie. You'll enjoy it. So Agatha Christie's been a part of my life as long as I can remember, and it's kind of fun to be able to do this, you know, as a sort of a tribute to Mom.
Well, Agatha Christie's one of those authors where once you get the bug, you could end up reading everything she ever wrote.
I think I pretty much have at this point.
Yeah.
And some of the ones I don't think, then I get about 2/3 of the way through and go, oh, that's right, I know who did it, you know. So, which is one of the things that also makes it fun.
Yeah, my father used to tear the little corner off the cover of paperback mysteries so that he would know that he'd read them. Otherwise, he'd constantly be finding himself rereading something and then knowing who the killer was halfway through. So
right, and it's like, oh, darn. barn.
Yeah, it's a common experience. But, you know, the mystery lovers are a special lot, and there's a lot of sort of acceptance of humor in stories that are essentially grim stories, but also the fun of unraveling something, right?
Right, of going in and wondering who, you know, oh, I think it's him. No, it can't be him. It's got to be him. No, maybe it's her.
Yeah. Well, now, so as you're you know, talking actors through the auditions, you've got to be able to sort of get them to that place, right? Where you're this on the surface, but you're also this underneath.
Right. And at last night's audition, it was great because there weren't a ton of people there, so I could read people in different characters and get different views of everybody who was there. So that was really nice. And it's fun to be able to put people through their paces like that too. Okay, now you're the sweet ingenue. Okay, now you're the sweet ingenue's friend who's kind of a bitch. And then now you're, you know, the little old lady, and now you're, you know, so, and they all enjoyed it immensely too, to be able to stretch themselves like that as well. So and I'm looking forward to sitting down and working on characters with people, and it'll be a lot of fun.
Are you satisfied that the actors coming in are sort of familiar with the conventions of, you know, novelists like Agatha Christie?
So far, yes. So they've either that or they've been in one of the shows before, so they're familiar with, you know, the way the plays work themselves out. I mean, one of the nice things about all of these plays is they translated the novels so well that it works out nicely. So sometimes, you know, things get lost in translation.
One of the things that once you're cast, one of your tasks as director is going to be to kind of sustain that tension until it's all sort of unraveled at the end. Does this follow that classic pattern of a denouement, you know, in the final scenes?
Yes, it does. It has the classic denouement. So it's, you know, it's standard Agatha Christie. That's what makes it so much fun.
So you've got to be able to sort of have the, you know, make sure that has its impact at the right moment in the timing of the show.
Well, the last time I did one of these Agatha Christies, there was a judge who has slowly gone crazy, and he has become the bad guy. Mm-hmm. And when everyone came into audition, they screamed his big monologue at the end, you know, and did crazy angry the whole time. And for me, quiet, scary, angry is a lot more scary, you know, is more intense than somebody who's sitting there yelling at you, because the yelling just gets exhausting after a while.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
And to explain to the actor that, you know, you can get loud here, but then get back soft again because it'll be creepier. And when he finally got it, people at the end were like, God, he was chilling. And it was like, you know, sometimes quiet anger and quiet scary is way more intense than the loud, angry, you know, coming at you in your face stuff.
Well, I think you're going to have a lot of fun with this show, Susie. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Well, thanks, Chris. It'll be playing, we open St. Patrick's Day and play till the 2nd of April.
All right. Susie Bond is the director of the upcoming Kilauea Drama and Entertainment Center production of Murder on the Tile by Agatha Christie. She's in the process of casting the play, and there's one more audition today at 6:30 at KMC's Kilauea Theater.
In honor of Valentine's Day, entertainer Willow Chang presents an evening of songs she calls The Seven Faces of Love on Saturday, February 11th in the Atherton Studio. They're beloved tunes from Broadway, jazz, pop, and beyond. Treat yourself and a loved one to tickets by calling 955-8821 during business hours or by going to hprtickets.org. Sponsored by Bonnie Rice and the Rice Partnership, Wealth Management.
The playwright Annie Cusick Wood has a real gift, Beth Ann, for taking something really complex and getting very young children to understand it. I don't know how she does it.
I've seen several of her productions, and this is the one that we talked about today. Is another one of hers that begins to touch on lots of different issues that let little kids get it, you know, have access to it. And it's fun to watch the parents watch the kids get it.
Yeah. No, it must be.
Well, that's going to do it for us for this day. But coming back tomorrow, now while we're talking about parenting, parents know that raising kids in the era of social media is tough. Now tomorrow we're going to talk with Justine Finn. She's the director of Relationshift. And we'll talk about social media, media and sex, opportunities, solutions, and challenges facing teens and kids, and what parents can do about it.
Plus, Leeward Theater presents Plantation Plays at their source. The conversation will be moving to 11 a.m. on HPR1 with a rebroadcast at 7 p.m. nightly. And that starts on Tuesday, the 14th, just coming up next week. Now, let us know what you think about that new schedule or about any of the stories you hear today. You can call our talk back line, leaving your comments at 808-792-8217. Email is talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
And if you'd like to hear any part of the show again or another one, just take a look at the archive on hawaiipublicradio.org.
I'm Chris Vandergrift.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll see you in the morning with more of The Conversation.